This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Stacy Wood's mom always wanted her to become a medical doctor. Instead, she specialized in marketing and consumer research. Not quite what her mother had in mind. But Wood's path did lead her to NC State, where she got a good job as a professor. And then in the early 2000s, Wood found a way to combine her mom's ambitions with her own. She learned that neuroscience can tell us a lot about our brains and how they respond to marketing and advertising, so she began to study the human brain. Stacy exposes people to marketing messages and uses MRI scans, then sees how their brains react, and it allows her to understand how the human mind processes advertising. Of course, it's useful to advertisers, but Wood found in a recent study the research can also shed light on deception itself and how it affects an aging mind and an injured brain. Stacy Wood is a professor of marketing at NC State's Poole College of Management, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here, Stacy.
Thank you so much.
So tell us more about this study. You're trying to figure out which parts of the brain light up when we're watching a commercial. That it?
In a way, we wanted to look at how people respond to differing levels of perceived deceptiveness in ads and see what parts of the brain are correlated with that kind of processing, how people learn to figure out what is true and what is fake, what's a false claim to avoid.
And when you talk about perceived deception, you're showing them ads and you had them on a scale of most deceptive to least. How did you determine that?
We used a pretest. We didn't want to say anything about the objective deceptiveness of ads. That would be making legal claims that we wanted to avoid. However, we did show pretest subjects ads that differed in how deceptive they were perceived to be, everything from a little device that plugged into your car's cigarette lighter to tell you how much battery strength you had left, to a similar device that plugged in and promised to remove all the bacteria and viruses from your car's air.
Aha. But so perceived deceptiveness then was something you did, you screened for, and how did you determine that?
We had people in a pretest look at these ads, rate them. We used expert judges. We used a number of different ways to make sure that we were really sure what a lot of people would see as ads that were believable, ads that were deceptive, and then a middle ground, what we called a moderately deceptive ad, what I like to call a maybe claim, like maybe it's true, maybe it's false.
All right, so that's the pretest. All those folks mm-hmm. are gone. You bring in the new subjects. You don't do. What do you tell them about why they're there?
Well, we tell them that they're there to look at advertisements. We don't tell them what we're interested in, though. And the reason why we did that is because we really wanted to mimic the everyday way that we are exposed to literally thousands of advertising claims as we walk around in our normal lives. And so they sat in the scanner, well, laid down actually, and as they saw these things, they processed them as they liked. We didn't tell them to evaluate these ads. We didn't tell them to judge the believability. They simply looked at them.
The scanner, meaning an MRI scanner,
that's
right?
Correct,
so now
yes.
We're going to look at exactly what's kind of lighting up. So what'd you find?
So we found a really interesting thing. Number one, I think the good news is that consumers are actually quite good at noticing and screening out deceptive ads. We found a two-stage process that was characterized first by attention orientation, meaning people's attention was riveted to more deceptive ads. The more deceptive an advertisement, the more activity we saw in the procuneus, which is an area of the brain associated with attention to, and threat detection.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, so we see those deceptive ads, we notice them. After this was followed a period of processing in the superior temporal sulcus and the temporal parietal junction, which are associated with an interesting kind of processing called theory of mind processing. That's all about how we judge other people's intentions and beliefs. And so
we got a part of the brain that does that all by itself.
Thank goodness. I think it may work better for some people than others.
Right.
But yeah, you can see when babies develop into small children and then larger children, we can see that developing right as they start to realize, hey, what I want in the world isn't what someone else wants, and what I intend isn't always what someone else intends. We start to make that separation. And so that's clearly something that helps us determine when someone else is lying to us. We try and think about what their intentions are in telling us information.
So that becomes more active when the first part of this process is enlivened. In other words, I have extra attention, meaning I perceive this as more deceptive. Now I'm engaging this other trying to gauge your intentions.
Exactly. And what we saw here that was interesting is that the most processing in this second stage went to those moderately deceptive maybe claims. The believable claims and the more deceptive claims showed less processing.
So does that mean they were if they were more deceptive by your scale earlier, then we rejected them out of hand? We didn't have to subject them to the second test.
We couldn't tell that from the from the brain scan data. So we had to collect some more data that was from traditional behavioral experiments, and it was interesting because we thought it could go either way, right? It could be that these maybe claims were actually more persuasive because people's attention locked on them, and then they thought about them a lot, which could mean that they remembered them more, they were more interested in them, that they were just more persuaded. Or it could mean that they were engaging in more critical thoughts about these types of ads that were a little more uncertain. And we found out that it was the latter. And I think this is fortunate for consumers. That second stage really was a discriminatory process where they were learning how to weed out things that were a little more uncertain. They were really quick at weeding out the highly deceptive and accepting the believable, and the moderately deceptive needed a little more work.
Now, this sounds like something that could very easily be used by marketers to help sell us more junk we don't need.
You would think
Stacey?
So. It's actually, I know. Yeah. Yeah, I love the, I do love the term neuromarketing just because it's so shady. Yeah. I don't use it myself. We talk about decision neuroscience because sometimes when you say the word neuromarketing, people have this idea of a buy button in the brain that marketers are looking how to tickle that and get you to, you know, buy more Pepsi Cola or Fluffo, as the case may be.
You can't get enough Fluffo.
It does lead to fluffier pie crust. And that's really just not how it works. What we found with this is that these maybe claims generate a large amount of brain processing, a large amount of attention and bandwidth. But it's not a good idea for marketers to then make their claims just a little edgier and a little bit more mysterious, hoping to get that bandwidth, because what we show is that consumers in the end are pretty good at discriminating and figuring that out. In the end, this study really comes to be something that hopefully medical researchers and people who are interested in consumer welfare can use to show what areas of the brain are necessary for this kind of processing so that, you know, should these be areas of the brain that are susceptible to decay with aging or to injury through concussive injuries, head injuries, we might actually have a start, you know, a beginning to understanding what might make people sort of more credible in terms of believing fake or false claims through neural causes.
But when you say that more bandwidth is engaged or our mind, we're more actively chewing over the possibilities here, how rational is that? I mean, are we really and how much is emotion and some of these other sort of psychological elements taking hold?
Well, as a researcher, of course, I'm going to say we need to have more studies that look at this. But the one study that we did conduct to back this up to look at whether that chewing over was a positive or a negative, and we thought it was quite possible that it would be a negative. It did show that what happened is that when people have time, when they had the time and the ability to process, they were quite discriminating. However, we did put them in environments of cognitive overload, meaning they had a lot of stuff to do cognitively while they were looking at these ads. And then we saw that the maybe claims were treated as exactly as the believable claims. They were just as persuasive as the believable claims, leading us to think that what happens is that consumers are tricked when they're in when they're looking at things with a lot of other, looking at ads with a lot of other things going on, when they've got a lot of other claims on their attention. And that's not surprising, right? You know, we really do need to actually stop and think about things in order to be discriminating. But yeah, when we're overloaded and the kids are pulling at us in the grocery store, those maybe claims might be both attention-getting and persuasive.
Well, is there any way to determine how much time we spend after the fact and over what period of time we spend in a deeper kind of deliberation?
In our studies, we found that 30 seconds was what it took. So we looked at the first 15 seconds looked like they were about attention orientation. The second 15 seconds really was about the critical discrimination. And after 30 seconds, people were pretty much done.
Well, so it doesn't really matter that we can download the book right then and there or order it on,
Yeah, and on one hand, you think—
A one-click buy may not be as disastrous as we think.
That's right.
So you also have you found this interesting difference between how people say they'll react versus how they do react to this thing, or how people believe that they're influenced by advertising.
Yeah, this is one of the strengths of decision neuroscience and being able to look at brain scans in marketing and other fields that look at consumer choice, a lot of times consumers have a hard time articulating their own processes. As a consumer researcher, we often study the brain as a black box where we look at the inputs going in and the outputs coming out and then try and make inferences about process. It's awfully cool to be able to, you know, open the lid of the black box a little bit and see what's going on, especially when so much of our research shows that people are very bad both at recognizing their own motivations, articulating their own processes. And sometimes it's a case of, I know what's going on, but I don't feel comfortable saying it if it's a sensitive topic, you know, like let's talk about people and their credit cards. And sometimes it's just a case of people aren't aware of when they're being influenced.
Well, and particularly when it comes to luxury goods, people have a kind of a conflicted idea about what's going on.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. I've got some cool new research with my colleague Adam Craig that looks at our response to luxury logos. And we find that interestingly, simply being primed with words that have to do with indulgence increases the neural desirability of those logos. But on the other side, for people who want to sort of tone down their shopping behaviors, merely being primed with cues that have to do with budgeting, saving, frugality, took those neural impulses away. So you might actually be able to help control the innate allure of luxury logos simply by the messages you surround yourself with. It may not just be pure self-control.
Stacy, so great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Stacy Wood, a professor of marketing at NC State's Poole College of Management. Just ahead, we're going to consider an exhibit of art inspired by life at the U.S.-Mexican border. And we'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.